Good afternoon. So last time we started off by talking about relating our cache organization and what misses and hits we have with a cache with looking at C code, especially C code that accessed arrays. I focused on arrays because, well, that's one of the cases where it's sort of most clear from the code how that might map to caches. And also, if you're dealing with a lot of data, you usually have an array involved somewhere. And when you're dealing with a lot of data, it's when you're going to care most about the caches, because if you are dealing with a small amount of data, usually the caches don't affect your performance much. You're going to have all cache hits because there's not much for the cache to do. Then we talked about a missing piece in discussing how caches work, which is how they would deal with writes. And we learned that, unlike with reads, where kind of thinking about locality gave us kind of a very obvious sort of best choices if we assumed locality, with writes, sort of the decisions about what to do were not so straightforward, and caches have made different decisions. And there were two decisions we focused on. One was, what do we do on a write miss? So a miss in a cache is when we try to look for a value and it's not there. So on a write miss, we could do what we do for reads, which is that we always add it to the cache. And that's what makes sense if we assume we have locality. But there are kind of two problems with that, which mean that that's not always the choice that caches make. So one problem is that, well, maybe the locality assumption works less well for writes, because if we're reading the value into the cache, we're not just assuming that because there was an access, there will be an access again soon. We're assuming because there was a write, there will be a read soon. And maybe that's not true so often. And another reason is that actually putting the value in the cache, and because it involves reading from the next level of memory, is like maybe disproportionately expensive. So for this reason, caches make a decision about whether they're write allocate or write no allocate, the sort of opposite policy when they're designed. And we had a second decision that, let's say we have the value in our cache for some reason, either it was a write hit, it was already there, or we added it with write allocate. Then there's a question, well, when do we actually tell the next level of the cache about the value that's being written? And the simplest answer is this write-through policy. And because that's simplest, that's something some real caches do, but it has this problem that it seems like we're updating the next level all the time, and the purpose of caches was to avoid talking to that next level that was going to be much slower, because it's bigger most of the time. So write-through seems to violate that, so we have an alternate option of write-back, where we keep the value only in the cache until our last possible chance to write it. And that's going to be when we have to get rid of it, perhaps because we're reading in something else to fill that space. And this has the disadvantage that we have to keep track of what we've modified, because we don't want to be writing everything back that we get rid of in the cache, because usually it won't be modified. And it also has the disadvantage that it makes now all our access to the cache that might evict something more complicated, because now eviction isn't just forget about a value and nothing. Now we definitely have to tell the next level about it all the, we have to worry about telling the next level about it to have that logic implemented and have the time to do that. So questions about these things we covered last time? Yes?
So does write no allocate just mean that it's
does write no allocate mean that it never writes to the cache? No. It means that we never write on a write miss. So whenever we access the cache, the first thing we always check is that value already in the cache? And if it's in the cache, on a write, we better update it, because we don't want to read back an old version. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? So some logistical things. So next week's lab is the code review lab. This requires in-person attendance or an arrangement with me. So if you can't go to the lab, you should talk to me or email me or something like that. Also, I will not be in town next Thursday or most next Wednesday. Professor Skadron will be covering lecture. There should be a lecture recording. Obviously, the logistics and how that's going to get uploaded will be different, so it might be delayed or something like that. But that is the plan for that. I will not be here Wednesday through Sunday, basically. So questions on logistics? Yes?
Do you suggest trying to improve our code syntax as much as possible before the lab, or wait till your feedback?
Question, I suggest trying to improve your code as much as possible before the lab, or wait to hear feedback? I would suggest getting it done early, and you'll have more useful feedback if it's what you think should be the final form, right? It's not very nice to say, here's my code, by the way, I know I need to change a bunch of stuff that you can't see here.
So you're not graded on how different your part two is to part three?
Question, you aren't graded on how different your part two is to part three. You are not, though we would hope that the differences would be explained by what happened. I guess the thing I'll emphasize in the code review is feedback on code style, readability, maintainability. It is not a debugging session. This is not, please debug my code for me. Also, the format we want you to have is that you're going to show code on your screen to other people. You're not transferring the code. You're not having them run it. You're not running it for them. It's looking at code and sort of commenting on, does this style make sense? Is this readable? Is this maintainable? Are there gotchas here? What I would suggest, more than the style, is if things aren't complete, you can't get feedback about them. Other questions? Yes?
Is it possible to attend a different lab time?
I'm not going to stop you with the caveat that if everyone does this, we might run out of room, and if we don't have room and you aren't registered for the lab, we're going to kick you out. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so I'm going to cover two last topics on caches. So briefly, I'm going to sort of clean up talking about write policies. And we said one of the motivations for not doing write through was that, we have to write to memory, that seems slow. And even with write back, it seemed like it had this problem that it made reads that would previously be pretty simple not require a whole bunch of talking to the next level of cache or main memory. But there's a trick that caches do that make this write-through policy and these sort of eviction writes, in practice, not actually that big of a deal, that make it pretty actually tolerable in most cases to have a write-through cache from a performance point of view. And that's that they can do the writes kind of in the background. And the usual main trick for this is that they'll have this little sort of mini cache called a write buffer that holds the pending writes. So for write through, the cache will say, I wrote this when it's in the write buffer, even if it hasn't made it all the way to the next level yet. And by having it in this write buffer, not only do we have it stored so we can eventually send it to the next level, we also have it stored so in case we read back the value, we can check the write buffer and make sure we don't read the old version from main memory. So as long as this write buffer doesn't get full, this kind of makes writes appear to happen instantaneously. Of course, it can get full, but especially with write back, the idea is that write back usually makes writes a lot less frequent, so it's not too likely to get full with most typical code. So questions? This write buffer idea. Okay, so that's all on sort of our caches for sort of data in memory. So we're going to talk about one other thing with caching, which has to do with our page table lookups. So with page table lookups, especially with multi-level page tables, which are the norm because we have, large-ish virtual addresses, we're doing all these memory lookups. And we should talk about, how does that work with caches? And, caches can help in kind of the most obvious way, which is that we can do our normal lookup process, and when I said previously, oh, we read a value from memory, we read it from cache. So that helps. But this actually turns out still to be quite slow. Even if we're reading all our page table entries from cache, we don't want to be doing this all the time. And this is especially true if we think of sort of modern 64-bit pointer systems, which typically have 4 more level page tables. So we have 4 level page tables. That would mean we do 5 cache accesses every time the program accesses memory. On a typical modern processor, cache access has a latency of like 2-ish cycles for the level 1 caches. So that would be like 8 cycles. That's a lot to have every memory access do. And generally is not acceptable. So how are we going to avoid this and still use this sort of multi-level page table structure that we really want to handle these big address spaces? Well, we're going to make a special faster cache for page table entries. And you might say, well, why are we convinced that we're going to be able to make a much faster cache for page table entries than sort of our just using our normal cache? That our level 1 cache that's already the smallest one we usually have, why are we going to do better? And kind of the key observation, if you look at what a program's doing, is that we think of like running a function. That function might have a few variables or arrays on its stack. It might have the accessing like some sort of thing that's malloced. It has sort of some code. So it's accessing a whole bunch of parts of memory. But if we think of this in terms of pages, if we're accessing like 4 kilobytes on our stack, that's probably 1 or 2 pages. Because a page typically is like 4 kilobytes, and we're accessing a 2-kilobyte array, maybe it spans 2 pages, but that's probably all. If we're accessing a function that has, you know, 500 instructions, that usually fits in 1 page. If we're accessing like a malloc array on the heap, that's, you know, only a couple kilobytes, probably usually in 1 page. So it turns out that sort of each of these areas the function is accessing when it's running are usually only a few pages, which means that if we want to remember where they are in physical memory, we only needed to know about a few page table entries. So this means that we can have a cache that is really, really small, and therefore much faster than sort of our more general L1 caches that are meant to handle kilobytes of data typically, and therefore we can make that cache much faster for accesses. So we're going to have a specialized cache which has the non-intuitive name TLB, which stands for Translation Look-Aside Buffer. That's just the name that IBM chose, and it's stuck in the literature. And it's a usually very small cache of page table entries. So rather than just storing sort of anything from memory, this cache only knows how to store page table entries. And in fact, it's more specific. Usually it only stores the last level page table entries. So if we have a 4-level page table, it's only going to store the entries from the 4th level. Everything else, we're not going to bother. We're not going to bother with the rest of it being cached. We'll just look it up if we need the other levels. And when we look things up in this cache, since we know it's a page table entry, the way we get to a page table entry is by doing this lookup whose input is the virtual page number, the whole thing. So we're going to have our TLB be indexed based on the virtual page numbers, not based on physical addresses. And because our page table entries sort of represent this big chunk of data or code, there's not much advantage to spatial locality in the TLB. Now, if just because we're accessing one page table entry doesn't make it especially more likely we'll access an adjacent one, so we'll store 1 page table entry per block. And to make this really fast, usually at least our level 1 TLBs will have tens-ish of entries. So we can make the lookup happen in hardware, you know, often in like a cycle or less by making it really small compared to our level one caches, which will lie typically thousands, and therefore the lookup takes a little longer. Okay. So we have our, you know, the key biggest difference is that we're kind of caching the result of the whole page table lookup. Just the entries from the last level page table that we would get at the end of that lookup. So questions on the TLB sort of idea. And I mentioned here that we have the entries from the last level page table. So we'll look at, we'll say that's what we're caching. And the key idea of this is that when we're forming our address, when we have a TLB hit, when things are in our cache, we just take the entry and we can use that directly to form an address. We don't have any extra steps. We get the physical page number from that entry, combine it with the page offset from the original address, and we're done. So to kind of illustrate this, here's our two-level lookup. When we have a TLB hit, we're going to take our virtual page number, take the whole thing. We don't have to worry about dividing it into pieces. We're going to send the whole thing to the TLB. And when there's a TLB hit, the TLB is going to give us our page table entry. We'll use it just as if we got that from the full multi-step lookup. We'll check all the bits in there, you know, permissions and so on. And assuming it's all OK, we'll take the physical page number, combine it with the page offset, and actually access the real cache. Yes?
So it seems this saves operations, but it's still involved the lookup. So how much more efficient is this for two levels versus more levels?
Question, how much more efficient is this for two levels versus more levels? So like, are you asking, is the TLB still worth it if we don't have multiple levels? It absolutely is, and that's primarily because of this difference here. Like, our main gain in efficiency is that we can make the TLBs really small because they don't need to store very much to be useful. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So this is on a hit. Now, of course, sometimes, because our TLB is a cache and is relatively small, sometimes the program will access something that's not in the TLB. In that case, we'll check the TLB, we'll find out it's not there, and we'll do the whole lookup, and we will send the result of the lookup to the TLB to save for later, and also we have the result of the lookup to use for that access. So we still have all that machinery to do that full lookup, the one you're implementing for the translate and the page table assignment. But the idea is that we only do that when the TLB doesn't have something in it. Okay. And so mentioning that we send the virtual page number to the TLB, so how does the TLB work? Well, the TLB is going to be organized the same way as our other caches, but rather than taking in an address, it takes in a virtual page number. So here, this virtual page number is the input to our TLB, and like our caches, we're going to split up the virtual page number into a tag, index, and offset. The offset in this case is empty because we store one thing for block, sort of one entry a block, implies 2 to the 0 offset bits. Something which sometimes confuses people is that we have our original address had a page offset. The TLB never sees that, doesn't care. Right, that's all handled outside. We look at our diagram, the offset, you know, this offset here never goes to the TLB. TLB doesn't use it in any way. And our TLB is going to contain sort of a bunch of page table entries, and we're going to split up our virtual page number into an index and a tag. We're going to use the index to decide which row to look at, and like with our caches, we might have multiple ways in our TLB. In fact, very often we will. So we'll look up the appropriate row, and we'll check the tag, see if there's a match, and if so, we'll get out our page table entry that is being stored there and use that for the rest of the sort of memory translation. Okay, so questions? This lookup process. Okay, so let's do, so here, so let's say I have a for entry, so that's, it stores four total page table entries. Two-way TLB. And I have a system with 4096 byte pages, that's 2 to the 12 bytes. Question is, how many index states does the TLB have, and what's the index when we're doing the whole lookup process for the virtual address 0x12345? Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks we have, let's do no index bits. One index bit, two index bits, okay, three or more index bits. Okay, so we have a split there. So for figuring this out, I would draw out our TLB, and we have two ways. We have kind of two columns, way 0 and way 1, and each of these contains some number of page table entries, which are the blocks in our TLB. And we have 4 in total, so I'm going to distribute 4 among here. So I have entry number 1, number 2, number 3, number 4, and I end up with 2 sets, 2 rows in our TLB. So this ends up having 2 sets. Therefore, we have 1 set index bit, because I needed 1 bit to number them. Possibly a point of confusion is, so 2 to the 1 sets in total. Some questions on how I figured that out? so let's do the second part. What is the index of this virtual address? When we're using the TLB to do our access to this virtual address, what index in the TLB will we use? So who thinks we'll use set 0? Okay, who thinks we'll use set 1? Okay, no clue? Okay, so Paul already answered set 0, which is what I agree with. So how would we figure this out? So we're going to take this address, and we're going to divide it up into a virtual page number and a page offset. It happens that our page offsets are 12 bits. So this is our page offset is the last 12 bits. So our virtual page number is 0x12, and our page offset is 0x345. That 0x345 doesn't get involved with the TLB at all. The TLB never sees it, doesn't care about it. So it's just going to get the 0x12. I'm going to rewrite that as binary for convenience. So we have a 1 and then a 2. 2, this is our 1. And we have no offset bits. And we have one index bit. That's our index bit. We have no offset bits because every block contains one entry. So there's zero offset bits. We don't need to figure out where we are in a block. And one index bit, and that is 0. So it is, in fact, set 0. So questions? How I figure that out? So then let's say I have this access pattern. My TLB is initially empty. Where are my TLB hits and misses if this is what the program does? I've given you what the program accesses, the results of any page table lookup as would happen, would have, and so on. would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks we have at least one hit? At least one. At least two. At least three. At least four. Okay, at least five. Okay. So it seems like our consensus is three, and that matches what I get. So I have sort of a listing of what I did. So there's two big red herrings in this question. One is that it doesn't matter whether the program's trying to read or write because it's never updating the page tables. And that's what's stored in the TLB. So these aren't writes to the TLB because we aren't updating what it's caching, right? It's just caching whatever's in memory before. You might say, well, how does the OS deal with update? What happens when the OS updates the page tables? We haven't talked about that and we're not going to test on it. But the OS actually has to run a special instruction to tell the processor, hey, I updated the page tables, fix up the TLB for me. But the program writing doesn't change what's in the TLB. The TLB is just doing the translation. It doesn't need to know whether it's a read or a write, except that we're going to use that information to check the page table entry later. And so we have our first access. We're accessing virtual page 440, and it's not in the TLB since it's initially empty, so then we're gonna cache the page table entry for it. Then we're gonna try to look up the same page. It's gonna be a hit next time. Then we're gonna access page 7 FFFE. That is that virtual page number. If we look at the least significant bit, it's 0, so it goes in it's at 0. Oh, I didn't write this soon enough. Zero. So we put it in there. It's a hit the next time we access there. Then we access 7 FFFD that has a 1 in the least significant bit. So that's going to go in set 1. It's going to be a miss since it wasn't stored before. Then we access 664, and we pick 440 because that's the least recently used thing in the TLB, which means that when we access virtual page number 440, it's going to be a miss the next time. And then we access 7FFD again. That's in set 1. Nothing else touched set 1 is going to be a hit. So questions? Figure that out. Okay, and the slide asks the final contents, so we can just list out what's in there, and we can compute the tags, which are going to be We strip the index off those virtual page numbers. Those are the tags that are stored in the TLB. And it's going to store the actual page table entry. So it's going to have the physical page numbers, all the permission bits. We could store the valid bit, but we have a valid bit for the cache anyway. So we probably will just ignore, you know, not keep the valid bit around since we know it's one if it's cached. Okay. Other questions? Or anything with TLBs. Now we're going to move on to talk about threading, which is going to be our next big topic in this class. And we're going to teach about sort of how to program using threads, and there's kind of two motivations for programming using threads. And I'm mentioning this because, like, there's some things that threading supports which, you know, might not make so much sense if you're thinking of threaded programming from only one of these two perspectives. So one motivation people have for writing code that uses multiple threads, that is, like, we have multiple sort of sequences of code that are running at the same time, is what we might call concurrencies, that we have different things happening at once. So, like, if I'm writing a web server, even though it's one program, maybe I want to use multiple threads because I want to have different code running to handle different users connected to my web server. Or if I'm writing a web browser, I might want each page in my web browser to have its own code running to handle that page, not to have to have one big piece of code, you know, that's switching between handling different pages. If I have a program that's playing audio and reading from the keyboard, maybe I have one thread handle playing the audio, one thread reading from the keyboard. And in the case of concurrency, a thing I'd like you to note is that we might want to use multiple threads in this case, even if it doesn't really provide us with sort of a performance benefit. This is often an organizational tool for us, that we're not actually sort of using multiple threads because we want to use multiple cores or multiple processors, even though maybe we will end up doing that. That's not the primary reason you're going to choose this concurrent threaded programming style. You're often doing it because it's just a more convenient way to write these programs. So there's another motivation for threading, which I'll call parallelism, which is we have one task to do, and we're going to deliberately split it up into pieces in order to take better advantage of resources. And we have an assignment which is definitely on this sort of idea of threading, the life assignment, where the idea is that we're running one task, which would probably be more straightforward to code as a single-threaded thing, as sort of one piece of code that's running one at a time. But we want to take advantage of having multiple cores that we have processors that can run different instructions at the same time to speed up that task. Some questions on these sort of two different, very different motivations for running programs that have these multiple threads. As we mentioned earlier this semester, threads are kind of like virtual processors. Okay. And we've already actually done programming with multiple threads when we did the fork assignment and the signals lab. You were running multiple threads, they were just in separate processes. So not only do they have sort of separate virtual processors, they had separate kind of virtual memory. Where we're gonna start talking about is like dealing with programming for multi-threaded processes. So we're gonna have one process with one process ID, sort of one set of open files, one set of memory, code and data, and so on, but multiple threads, and each of these threads are gonna have the resources that we kind of associate with running on a processor. They're gonna have their own registers, their own program counter, and typically their own stack. Now, here, as I've drawn things, it kind of looks like, oh, this thread is the only thing that can access its stack. Generally, our thread stack is gonna be in the same address space, meaning that technically, you know, this thread here could have a pointer to the other thread stack somewhere and dereference that pointer, and that'll just work. It's all going to be the same memory, as we'll see later. It's just that their stack pointer, you know, So the stack pointer will definitely point to the same thread stack. So that you could have other pointers to other thread stacks. We'll see cases where that actually happens later on. So questions about this sort of idea of a multi-threaded program? Okay, so we're going to talk about creating threads, and we're going to go over the POSIX API, which is called pthreads. And the function for creating a thread in that, which is in declared in pthread.h, is pthread create. And kind of similar to POSIX memoline, it has this pattern where what you might consider its return value is actually something you pass a pointer to fill in. So we have a thread ID, which is basically like a PID stored in a pthread T that this function fills in, and it returns a value indicating whether it was successful or not. So 0 indicates it's successful, non-zero would be like if you're out of memory, or like if you pass a bogus pointer for one of the arguments that you're not supposed to do that. And in this example here, I have my main function. I make a thread that's running this compute py function, and a thread that's running this print class list function. And when I call pthread create, both of those threads will start running, and the main function will keep running. So this is very similar to how, if we call fork, the new process starts running here. We call pthread create, the new thread starts running. Unlike fork, pthread create does not do this thing where it returns twice in different threads. Instead, pthread create will call the function we specify, and when that function returns, the thread will exit. So questions about this sort of simple example of what pthread create does? And we'll go over what the arguments that are null are in a bit. Okay, so we have this pthread create. So we have our first argument is the place to put the thread identifier. This second argument that I've left, this third argument that I've not left as null is the function to run. This is where the thread starts. When this function returns, the thread is terminated. It's not running anymore. And we have two other arguments. So the first one is what pthread's manual page calls the thread attributes. So these are extra settings for the thread. If you want to control how the thread is created, that's where you can do it. And we have this here, null, the fourth argument here that I've always passed null for becomes the thread's function argument. So you notice that the functions I'm calling always, for the start a thread, always take a void star argument and return a void star argument. That is required. That is the only type you can pass a function you're supposed to pass in. And we're passing the void star argument as the fourth argument here. And we'll see later how we can retrieve the return value void star when we're waiting for threads. So questions? Yeah. So your question is, what happens if instead of naming compute py, I name a function which doesn't take any arguments? So that's going to be a type error. Now you can try to cast your way out of it. On the systems we use, that's not going to be a problem. Technically, it's undefined behavior. And whether it's a problem or not, to think about whether it would be a problem, think about what happens if you write assembly code that calls a function that takes an argument as if it doesn't have arguments. You know, if that goes wrong on your platform, so on 64-bit x86, it doesn't go wrong, but there's some other platforms where it would, then you'll have a problem. Other questions? Yeah.
I wonder what occasions will we use multi-threading rather than
What? On the what?
Under what occasions would we use threads instead of forking?
Under what occasions would we use threads instead of forking? So our main advantage is we have this multi-threaded process that shares sort of all our sort of memory. So that's the big thing we're going to be able to take advantage of. That's going to be easier to share information between threads that are in the same process than if they were in separate processes. So there are advantages for forking. So the biggest one is since they don't share things, they're independent as far as like if one crashes, the other won't, right? That's not really going to work out with a multi-threaded process where the OS probably doesn't know what to do if one of them crashes, one of the threads crashes, and they can have independent memory, which might be an advantage. Independent open files too, which might be an advantage as far as like not having a huge number of files open by one process. Yeah. If your computer only has a single core processor, would multi-threading be redundant, you say? So this is why I went over sort of our motivations for threading. And if you're doing this concurrency thing, you might think it's an advantage to have multiple threads, even if you know it's all going to run on a single core, just because it makes it easier to write these programs. And on a single core, you can think of it as that if you didn't have multiple threads, you need to write a program that switches between play audio 4-bit, read from the keyboard 4-bit, play audio 4-bit, read from the keyboard 4-bit. You could write that program, but it's easier to write multiple threads and have the OS handle that switching for you. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So let's look at an example here. So here I have a program that I run a thread that runs this print message function, which prints in the thread. I print about to start thread and done starting thread afterwards. And when I run this on my machine, I ran this a lot of times, and about 4% of the time it printed in the thread. The rest of the time it just didn't print out. What happened? Any? Any volunteers tell me what happened here? Yeah.
Main return before print message return.
Main return before print message return. Yes. So that's what happened. And there's something special about main returning. It's that returning from main exits the process, not the thread, the process. So basically what we were doing is that in main, we were calling pthread create that started this print message thread, but if main got to the end before that printed out anything, the process went away and the OS said, okay, don't need to run any of these threads anymore because the process is gone. And this is what we might call a race condition. And a reason we can think of this sort of general idea of race conditions is that we have this sort of non-deterministic behavior depending on what happens first, what wins a race. And the race here is, can return zero happen first or the printf happen first? And depending who wins, we got different behavior and it's not predictable. And this sort of thing can cause bugs. So questions on happened here, yes. Is there a wait thread? Yes. So there is, and it's called pthread join. And that would be our fix for this problem. So pthread join will wait for that other thread. You might wonder, what's this second argument here? This is, if not null, this is where to put return the thread's return value. similar to wait PID taking a place to point the status. Okay. So this would fix that problem, make it consistently print in the thread. Sometimes it would print in the thread before printing. Done starting thread, sometimes after, because they're running at the same time, and it depends who gets to run first, but at least it would always print in the thread. There's another solution to this, because you might say, gosh, it's kind of silly that exiting main exits the entire thread, so exits the entire program instead of just that thread, and there's in fact a way to exit only one thread with the pthread exit function. I don't recommend this, but it is possible. Main is just very special in that when we exit from main, it exits the entire process. This normally doesn't happen. Yeah?
Like, would that be valid, though? Don't you need a return statement?
Question, don't you need a return statement? No, for two reasons. So one reason why is the same reason as if I called, like, abort or exit 0, right? The same idea that this function doesn't return, so it doesn't matter what happens after it. The other reason why is that C has a special rule for main that if main doesn't return, it returns 0. And that only applies to main.
So that if main means nothing, it could be like void main, it could be the same thing.
Question, could be void main do the same thing? So void main is not defined technically, but there's a special rule in the C standard saying that if you have int main and it doesn't return, you don't have an explicit return statement, it returns 0 for you. But the bigger reason why is that pthread exit doesn't return, so we don't have to worry about what happens after it. Okay. Other questions? Yeah?
So, if you use a pthread exit, does,
Question, if you use pthread exit, does the process exit when all the threads have exited? Yes. So I don't recommend this, but this is supported. Why don't I recommend it? I think usually when you're starting a thread, you want to figure out, you want to somehow manage when it finishes. And also, usually you want to have one thread in charge of figuring out when the program should exit, rather than having it kind of by accident. So I think most programs, this organization does not make sense. Okay, so we have pthread join, and I didn't show it, but pthread join, so we can have a place where it's going to put our return value. That's the thing the function pthread create ran returned. So we can optionally pass that instead of a null pointer. And also, it returns a value which tells us whether it was successful or not. So for example, if I call pthread join and I call it on an invalid thread ID, it might tell me that with the return value. Just like wait PID has the same feature where if you call wait PID and there's nothing to wait for, it will tell you that. And pthread exit, you notice, had this thing that's passed to it. Like exit, this is going to be what becomes that return value that we can retrieve with pthread join. And I guess something I didn't mention explicitly is that wait PID had this restriction that we can only wait for things we forked. Pthread join does not have that restriction. We can wait for any other thread in the process. And before I talk more about pthread examples, something I'd like to note is that what this sort of return value mean, because we've seen this sort of pattern with pthread create and pthread join, and pretty much all the functions whose names start with pthread have this pattern that they return a integer that tells us whether they succeeded or not. And the manual page will tell you sort of the special constants those could have if something goes wrong. So for example, pthread create says it's going to be equal to the special constant e again if we're out of memory, for example. And pretty much all the pthread functions we're going to use have this feature. Often my slides will not be checking these return values for space. That doesn't mean you shouldn't, especially if your code is buggy, because it might tell you where the problem is. So let's talk about using threads, and I'm going to use an example from that sort of parallelism camp, but we're going to solve one problem with multiple threads. And the problem we're going to solve in a whole bunch of examples, so I have this array of values, and I'm going to get the sum of everything in the array, and I'm going to try to use multiple threads to do it with the idea that if I have multiple cores, hopefully this will end up being faster. And my first simple strategy for doing this is I'm going to have two different functions I'll run, hopefully on two different cores. I have one sum front, which is going to sum the front half of the array, and sum back is going to sum the back half of the array. And I'm going to have my sum all function going to create two threads to sum the front and the back, then wait for both of them, and then return the results. And it's going to get the results because the threads are just going to store to this global array here, which we're going to add up the two partial sums to get the overall sum. So questions on how this code works? Okay. So we have this simple code that does sort of a sum across two threads, and using this trick of returning our values through these global variables, you might observe maybe there's a better way of doing it. We'll talk about the ways of doing that later. So when this runs, we're going to have two new stacks created because we're running two threads. So each of those two new threads are going to have their own stacks. And those threads are also going to have their own registers with their own program counter and their own stack pointer and so on. So the sum front thread will have a pointer to its stack, the sum back thread will have a pointer to its stack, our program counters will point to the sum front and sum back functions, and they'll both be accessing the shared memory that has these sort of global variables, values, and results as they are. Okay, some questions? Yes, yeah. Is there a specific maximum number of threads? Generally not, except what sort of resources you have available. Because we need to, most obvious thing on this diagram is we need to allocate a stack for each of them, so we need space for that. And we also need space for the OS to do whatever tracking of threads it needs to do. Other questions? Okay. So something you might not like about this example is I kind of have very redundant code here. I have like two sum functions that are basically identical except for some changes, and I had this argument I was just ignoring that seems like kind of wasteful. Maybe I could write one function that actually uses an argument, so let's do that. So here, I'm doing this trick. So the argument to this function has to be a void pointer to void, because that's the only type pthread create accepts. And I'm doing this trick here, which is not uncommon, that rather than using that as a pointer, I'm just shoving a number in that pointer. And then converting it back to a number in the function. So I'm taking the value I, which is going to be 0 or 1 in this for loop down here, and I'm passing the 0 or 1 as the address 0 or the address 1, having the function convert it back to a number rather than dereferencing anything or anything like that. So each of them get this sort of ID, which is 0 or 1, and they use that to compute what elements of the array to access and where to put their results. And now instead of having a separate sum front and sum back function, I have one sum function and my two calls to pthread create run that function in slightly different ways for the two threads. Some questions? How this code works? Yes?
Would this not work if results
are not global? So we would need some other way to have the results, then write the results back if it wasn't global. And we will give some examples later. Other questions? So we still have these global variables, and that might not seem so great, so let's do this without global variables. And if we're not going to use global variables, it seems like we have to somehow pass in values and results to the threads, right? That needs to be passed to the threads if it's not going to be in a global variable. We only have one place we can pass it in, so like I can't add extra arguments for it, so I have to put everything in one argument. How am I going to do that? Well, a struct. So a way I can do that is I can make a struct that has all the things I want to pass to the thread. In this case, I'm not going to pass values for now, but I'm going to pass the start and end location and where to place the result. And I'm going to make an array of these structs, set up one for each thread. So I'm going to set the start and end, pass the struct to a thread, converting it to a void pointer. I don't actually need a cast to do that. Things convert implicitly to void pointers and back in C. Wait for the threads, and then because the threads are using that struct to store the result, I can read it back from there. I don't need a global variable to do it. I still have the values shared. We'll get rid of that in a future step. The values, sorry, as a global variable, we'll get rid of that in a future step. But how we're going to get rid of that, we're going to add a pointer to it to the struct. So questions on this idea of passing a pointer to a struct? So something you might notice we're doing is that we're passing a pointer to a struct, and where is that stored? And well, I declared it in sumAll here. So the struct is pawn the stack of the sumAll function. If I say, wait a moment, we're accessing something from this other thread that's on another stack, isn't that a problem? Nope, because everything has the same address space. Everyone has the same memory. That they have different stacks, but those stacks have different addresses, so it's not a problem. We can have a pointer to another stack. We can dereference things on that stack. It's not going to be an issue. So that's what's going to happen, is that we're going to have our two threads. They're going to have their own stack, and they're going to have, a pointer to the main thread stack. They're going to access things on the main thread stack, and as long as the sumAll function is still running, that's not a problem. And you might say, how do we know that that local variable will stay around? Well, we know it will stay around because we wait for the threads to finish before we go out, it goes out of scope. So we don't have to worry about those things we have pointers to getting deallocated while the threads are running because we're waiting for the threads. Questions? Yeah. Question, if you create a thread first and then designate the info information, it wouldn't work right? So you're saying, like, if I did this here? Yes, so that would be a problem because the thread could read this start variable before we set it.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that's part of the problem. Another part is, would that make info not in the global array?
Question, would that make info not in the global array? Info is not in the global array at all. Here. But it isn't an array that's on the stack. So I guess another thing you might propose is, like, could I have, instead of have a thread info that's just a local variable in here and pass a pointer to that? And the answer is no, because it would go away before the thread is finished, before the thread finishes its work, right? And you have to ensure that the info that the thread is accessing stays around. Does that answer your question? Yes. Could threads access variables from other threads? If they know the address, yes. And in this case, they know the address because we gave it to them. That answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. So the key thing is that a multi-threaded process has one page set of page tables, so everyone can access the same addresses. Yeah. Question, if we mess up the numbers, mess up the start and end, would the threads be able to communicate? What do you mean by communicate?
As in, would they correct each other's data, or would we give a set of information from one thread to another and affect the threads?
So one question is, can we set information from one thread to another? Yes. So like if we pass two threads pointers to the same info struct, they're sharing it. And if one thread writes, the other thread might see what's being read. We'll talk as the next major topic about how to do that in a way which works consistently, but that's going to be something we'll take advantage of later. We'll want some other tools to make that work consistently. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. So, and I mentioned we still have this sort of global values array. We can get rid of that by just putting a pointer to some values array in the struct we pass, and then we can have a version of this which doesn't use any annoying global variables that you've probably been told not to use, and we will have some assignments tell you not to use. And you see here I'm just using the pointer from the struct, you know, and I'm setting the pointer the same in both of the structs. And in this case, the thread doesn't need to care about where the values are actually stored. So something we needed in this function still, though, is we still have the thread info that's being accessed while the threads are running, and it still needs to stay around the whole time the threads are running, which means that we start these threads, and then we're doing nothing until they finish. So another pattern we might often want with threads, if you want to start threads to do something and then check on them later and finish them up and do something else in between, that seems a little very annoying to do with this design. So we can change that by moving our thread info to the heap. And how I've done that here is I've, instead of having an array that's a local variable, I just allocate an array for my thread infos on the heap. And I have this start sum all function return a pointer to that array. And then I have a finish sum all function which uses the information in that array to wait for the threads, collect the return of values, and free everything. And by doing this, since I don't have any local variables, I don't need to worry about them going out of scope while the thread is running. The thread will just work normally. Okay. So questions about this design? And I guess I did this handy thing that I had, I had room in the struct. I can store information to find the thread later. It's a convenient place to put it. Questions about this design. So here we have, you know, the two threads running. They both have pointers to this info array on the heap that has pointers to the actual values they're manipulating and all the metadata they need to run. And it's also where they store their results. So, looked at how threads work. Let's do an example here. So, here's some code that is broken. What are some things that are wrong with it? Okay, so first I'll go over what this code looks like it's intended to do. So we're going to start a thread to run this create string function. It has a string. We run this compute string utility function to compute it. And then we return it. Returning an array converts the array to, you try to use an array as a pointer, converts it to a pointer to the first element. So that's what we're returning from this. That converts implicitly to void star. And then we're using pthread join to retrieve that pointer that's returned to that string, and then printing out the string. That's what the code is intended. Someone tell me one thing that is wrong with this code. Yes?
Is it because, like, after thread finishes, where the pointer is pointing to is no longer, like, where the string stack is because the thread is already finished?
So you're saying that the problem you see is that this pointer here, after the thread finishes, it points to something that no longer exists. Yeah, that is the primary problem with this code. Yeah?
When you're creating your thread, doesn't create string have to be borrowed, like an ampersand?
Question, when you're creating a thread, don't I need the syntax at create string? Both work. This is an oddity about how function pointers work in C, is that you can use extra ampersands or not. And same with stars for function pointers. Yeah?
So for pthread join, does it copy the return value of pthread join into the second argument, or does it copy the return value of the function that
it's? So the question is, what is being copied by pthread join? What is being copied is the return value, which is an address. So let's say our string is at 0x10000. This is going to be equivalent to string pointer equals char star of 0x10000. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Other questions? Yeah.
So is there any error in create string doesn't return a void pointer?
Question, is there any error because create string doesn't return a void pointer explicitly? No. C has a special rule that any non-function pointer will convert implicitly to a void pointer without a cast. This is not true in C++, which is why many people think casts are necessary in those cases, but it is true in C. Yeah, and other problems you could have pointed out are that I'm not checking whether pthread create or pthread join failed. Those are also problems. But the main problem is that our string pointer points to a stack, which when the thread we join the thread, the stack is gone. Yeah?
Could you go back?
Yeah?
If you could join, if our second argument was like string copy, and then that worked.
If our second argument was string copy, what do you mean?
Like you did string copy, then you just removed our star now.
String copy here? So if I string copy, so the issue here is that this is stored on the stack of the thread.
Right.
So if I copy the string to something on the heap, then it would be okay.
Okay.
But I need to do some extra memory allocation to have a safe place to store the string. Does that answer your question? So if I malloc space and then string copy, that would solve the problem. Then, yes, I'm over time, so I'll take questions up here.